slowly turns into a problem when another issue is mentioned. It goes so far that Colonel Fazlullah is harshly confronted by the then Minister of War. This is what lies at the heart of the issue, the training of Iranian officers. It is approved that a number of sergeants will train Iranian officers, but these sergeants will not be coming to Iran from England, but from the Indian Army. And the officers can only be promoted to the rank of captain. Higher ranks must only be employed from the British Army. The colonel is faced with statutes that weaken Iran's army, something totally against the agreement. A familiar theme for the people of Iran, a difference between the text and essence of the agreement. The same had happened during the Goldsmith Treaty, the Paris Treaty, the Treaty of Turkmenchay, the Treaty of Golestan, and others. The colonel's objections are useless. He's chosen another way to make his voice of opposition heard. Suicide. Even though the colonel committed suicide only with the knowledge he had of the agreement's third article, he unveiled the oppressive nature of the agreement. That started the first of the protests and created an atmosphere which allowed the agreement to be exhaustively scrutinized. This is how Sayyid Hassan Mudarris voices his criticism of the agreement. Things become so heated that nationalists and religious forces come together in opposing the agreement. Mohammad Mossadegh, using the keyword deception, begins to criticize the agreement. Nationalistic fervor soon reaches the southwest of Iran. The protests are centered here, in Tabriz. The bazaar is shut down by shop owners, schools are closed, and after scuffles, the gendarmerie is now under the control of the people. The leader of these protests is Sheikh Mohammad Khiabani, a well-known figure in Iran's political landscape. Vosokhodole's defense of the article gives the British the permission to employ their own people and infiltrate in any part of the government that they deem noteworthy. The protests in Tabriz are followed here by the founder of the jungle movement, Younes Ostad Sarayi, known as Mirza Kuchak Khan Jangeli. In his newspaper called The Jungle Paper, he refers to the agreement as a document to sell Iran. This agreement also has monetary obligations. The people have to pay from their own pockets for the British to oppress them. Of course, it is framed as a loan to Iran in order to achieve articles of the agreement, which include employing the British in the government and the purchase of their used weaponry. This is how Abdullah Mostofi, the writer of the book, The Story of My Life, refers to the loan. Mirzadeh Eshqi criticizes the fourth article in the form of a poem. The agreement also has a solution for the improvement of public transportation in Iran. England generously agrees to it, to allow Iran to have a railway system. This article can be considered positive and in line with the development of Iran. But why does Iran even need the consent of England to have a railway system? And the basics of choosing a contractor for national projects is soliciting tender offers, not imposition by a certain country. In the last article of this agreement, England wants to free the customs services, an organization that is under their own occupation. Even if this article leads to its release, it is nothing but bargaining over an irrefutable right. As the protests continue, Farrokhi Yazdi also uses poetry as a sword to oppose the agreement and addresses Vosuq. But it's not only Farrokhi Yazdi and Mirzadeh Ishqi who use literature as a weapon to criticize the agreement. Yahya Dolat Abadi, Dehkhoda, Malik al-Shu'ara Bahar, and even Iraj Mirza write poems and contents in their opposition to the agreement. Of course, there was a price to pay for those with a critical pen. Mirzadeh Ishqi and Farrokhi Yazdi are imprisoned because of their poetry. Ordinary people joined the National Solidarity Movement by staging shutdowns and walkouts, sit-ins in mosques and streets, and unite against the agreement. This is Sheikh Abdul Hussein Mosque, the center of the protests in Tehran. In a controversial act, Vosuq orders an attack on a gathering at the mosque and 17 prominent figures are arrested. It seems as if Vosuq has lost control of the situation. Sepah Square is near the mosque, and even the heavy rainfall cannot stop the people of Tehran from staging huge protests. Iran is drowning in the fury of the people. Protests are held in every single corner of the country. Everyone, regardless of their party and group affiliations, with any political and religious belief, is protesting against the agreement. Every single one wants only one thing, the annulment of the agreement. The signing of a secret agreement which was meant to lift sanctions and spin the wheels of the economy and politics in Iran showed its true colonial nature with the suicide of Colonel Fazlullah. The agreement now faces the widespread opposition of the people from every party, class, and status. It's an agreement that is bitter, but not the only one of its kind in Iran's history, which has been full of ups and downs. But it seems this agreement is somehow different from the ones before it. If only this was the end of it. Unfortunately, the story of the agreement does not end here. A sad story and its ending chapter is written not in Tehran, but somewhere 4,400 kilometers away, in a place in the Green Continent. A developed city with the River Thames flowing through it. It's exactly here, London. Not too far from the Big Ben Clock Tower, the editorial office of the Times. This is the exact location where the last page of the agreement is, in the newspaper's archives department. Among the masses of paper, an interesting headline can be seen. The headline of the agreement between Iran and England. What can be seen following the title is the details of the agreement. Details that are not very different from what we already know. But this newspaper reveals a huge mystery of the agreement for the first time. The answer to the mystery is not in its headline or the body of the article, but hidden in the top of the page. Exactly here, on top of the page, where the date of the paper is printed. August 16, 1919, which falls on Mordad the 24th, 1298 on the Iranian calendar. Take a look at the date of the publication of the agreement in Iran, the 17th of Shahrivar, 1298, which falls on September 9, 1919. The difference is obvious. This means that the agreement was signed at least 24 days before it was made public in Iran. But here's the question. When the agreement has already been signed, what was being negotiated during those 24 days? What delays the negotiation process? The answer can be found in this telegraph from British ambassador to Tehran. It seems what prolonged the negotiations was not the text of the agreement. The agreement has annexes too, and the bargaining was over these annexes. The closest I got to becoming successful in this mission was lowering the asking price to 400,000 tomans. To be fair, I must inform you that when it came to asking for money, Vosukhodole was not as unrelenting as the other two ministers, Nosratodole and Saremodole. They truly made life a living hell for me. It seems we have to accept a reason for the negotiations taking so long. A bribe. Years later, the bribe is attacked in an editorial in the Times by the opposition of the British government. We persuaded the Anglophile government of our own creation in Iran, and with the help of a bribe of £130,000 stolen from the British taxpayer, we wanted to popularize the Anglo-Persian agreement. The British people did not know about the bribe, but the Iranian population did. Aside from clarifying the sum of the bribe, the editorial also includes a bitter confession. The confession to the creation of an Anglophile government in Iran by the British themselves. In the court of history, these documents are witness that it was the British who caused the famine. The British who brought Vosukhodole to power and by sending Ahmad Shah off to Europe were busy colonizing Iran based on a completely calculated plan. The savior of Iran is the blood of Iranians like Colonel Fazlullah. A tragedy is a writing or a play which has a sad theme, and usually showcases miseries, physical and mental torture and betrayal. After a century, we talked about the tragedy of the Anglo-Persian Agreement of 1919. But how will history narrate the future tragedies of Iran?
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood. And currently we are focusing mostly on the first and second sermon of Nahjul Balagha, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about the circumstances that were present at the time of the coming of the messengers and prophets. And we shared a reminiscence with the present day era, where we see that the same issues that were occurring before the coming of the messengers, today also we see those same circumstances coming. And therefore, we are also in need of guidance, just like the times of the previous generations were in need of that guidance. And of course, our situation is different because the final messenger has already come. So in the absence of these messengers, how do we get that guidance? The most important thing is to receive that guidance. About that guidance, inshallah, I will come and explain about that very soon. But for now, the important thing is to understand those circumstances in which we were as human beings at the time of the coming of the messengers, and also compare it with the situation of today, and we see that similarity is there. Especially the aspect of confusion, the aspect of different, you know, human beings, everyone having a different idea about reality, and that idea about reality actually influencing the way they act in life, and then leading to that disunity that we see that there is today. Inshallah, when we come back, we're going to discuss more about this.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when we talk about this issue of confusion, we say that many of the communities and many of the countries of the world, many people of the world, many nations, they were in this state. They started to struggle and fight against the colonial authorities, but then the colonial powers, they decided to change their tactics, and they used a softer approach, which meant that they would aim at the minds and the hearts and the souls of the people, and not forcefully and coercingly try and control people's lands. And this was a very, very accepted, very, very much, you can say, a fulfilled plan by them. So they had so many independent countries of the world, but are truly just dependent countries, unfortunately, because of that cultural war, that cultural influence of some of the Western countries on these various nations. And therefore, from these nations, we find a few nations that were able to have steadfastness against this cultural invasion. And one of them was, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which came up with a new system, in fact, a system that was quite strong, that could challenge the systems that exist in the world today. And that was the system of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Islamic Revolution. And this revolution is based on very firm fundamental principles, and it is something that is going to be able to challenge properly the cultural invasion that the West is trying to wage on different countries of the world. The only thing is that is to realize that before the Islamic Revolution, Iran faced quite similar circumstances. A large group of the people, you'd notice, did not have that you can say that insight and that awareness and that astuteness with regards to political issues. And they were culturally influenced by the West and the Western hegemonic powers, and therefore the country was quite malleable under the hands of the hegemonic powers. So they needed something to remove this hegemony, and that was the revolution.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when the revolution happened, it came up with an apparatus that truly was, revolutionary in its essence. It didn't accept elements of the Western society into itself. On the one hand, it was able to quite, deftly control the environment in such a way that some of the positive aspects of the Western academia and Western, technology was able to be introduced inside, and the other aspects, unwanted aspects, were quite easily thwarted because of the way Islam is, the way monotheism is, the teachings of monotheism, the teachings of Islam and Quran, and the way the Shia Islamic system works is that it wouldn't allow that cultural influence of the West. And now we had a very powerful challenge. And this challenge goes on. And we see the challenge happening today even. And because of that challenge is what we see today, that the Western world and some of the hegemonic powers are, brought to their knees with regards to trying and controlling Iran. They cannot. Because that cultural apparatus that exists within the Iranian society that was inspired by the revolution is so strong that it can buffer the effect of this cultural invasion. And this cultural invasion is a multifold and multifaceted, attack from these hegemonic powers. It's not just a one-sided attack. It is from all sides. It's like a hybrid war, which includes a little bit of hard power, but a large amount of soft power. And this needs a very strong, cultural base to be able to defend it. And luckily, alhamdulillah, this cultural base is there. So we need that. We need to be able to receive that guidance in different times of different parts of our lives. The prophetic guidance to be able to have that steadfastness in the right direction. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. We've been looking at the components of an Islamic identity, starting off with understanding what the I is inside of me, traveling towards the power of thoughts, and yesterday we talked about the fact that the Islamic identity is a mind, body, and soul reality. And my entire purpose last night was this idea that we cannot simply ignore that dimension of the deen that does ask us to live a physically enabled life, meaning that how we dress and what we wear and what we eat and how we live a physical life in this world is all part and parcel of this identity. And we move on from this discussion on the components of the identity, and today and tomorrow, maybe even the next day, we look at the barriers. Theoretically, it sounds great. Right? On paper now, for the past six lectures, it's all kind of been theory. But on the ground, and a lot of my parents can attest to that, who have younger kids now, entering those teenage years now, and trying to kind of inject this Islamic pride inside of them is a challenge. There's fear, a little bit of anxiety. There's a lot of worry now. And as a father of three, I'm with you as well. My eldest being 13, my youngest being 6. It's a challenge. And to my young guys who are right now listening to me, late teens, early 20s, mid-20s, there's one thing that I want to mention right off the bat in the beginning. And there might be a lot of you right now who are on the fence, who perhaps maybe don't believe you have all the tools, the courage, to be able to do what I'm asking myself and all of you to do, and that is to really bring home a solid, strong Islamic identity. Let me take you through a little bit of history in the beginning. Inshallah, we'll get to the first barrier on this path. I have an immense affinity towards young people. I'm inspired by them. I find that individuals who are fighting the fight on the ground today to be incredible. Sometimes they'll slip, sometimes they'll fall, sometimes they'll have days and weeks where they're confused. But this dismissal sometimes that we have as a community, as a generation of today's youth, as I mentioned before, Maghrib in Pickering, the idea that, you know, the entire generation is a waste now, these guys are useless, blah, 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 I don't share in that discussion. Because it's my phone that blows up, right? It's the talks I have with a 16-year-old who's trying to understand God. And to the point where, you know, on the other side of the phone now, there's tears that I want to believe in God, but it just doesn't make sense to me. This portion, that dimension, this discussion. And this fight that they're fighting is that they want to avoid inheriting the religion from mom and dad. They're tired of praying because dad says so. They're tired of coming to the mosque because they're dragged here. It has to come from within, and they want it to come within, but sometimes they're bound by their own principles. This blind faith that they refer to that doesn't sit well with them. And we know from history that once a young person accepts the truth, that's it. They will work very hard now to preserve that truth. Again, I mentioned this a couple of nights ago. To me, the most powerful stories in the Quran is that of Nabi Musa. His entire story is filled with lessons that apply, I think, to us today. To me, one of the most powerful scenes from the story of Nabi Musa is probably his most famous moment, where he defeats the magicians of Fir'aun. These vetted magicians that he searched Egypt up and down, very confidently now, to bring down Musa, alayhi salam. As you know, didn't happen. Nabi Musa now defeated them in front of all of Egypt. That's not the point that gets me. The point that gets me is that when they were able to see the reality and the truth, nothing mattered at that moment. It's incredible. Here they were, the people of Egypt, that were frightened by Fir'aun, were controlled by Fir'aun. This is a man who not only would control everything about them to the point where he would even dictate to them who to worship. If you want to worship somebody, if you want to see who's worthy of worship, there's nobody better than me, Fir'aun would say. So something as private as worship even, he would hijack, oppress them, rule them using fear. And so any sort of even a glance towards Fir'aun, nobody would do it. And here you have the biggest day of the year in Egypt, the day where everyone comes out, watching this unfold. These seven, I believe, the hadith says, magicians, saw what they saw, and on the spot with Fir'aun sitting on his throne in front of his own people, saying that we now believe in the Rabb of Musa. That's not even the part that gets me. The part that gets me is that Fir'aun becomes livid. He just loses himself. Imagine now the embarrassment. He was convinced, the way he even attended that event, his throne was draped in jewels and diamonds. He himself was draped from head to toe. This was a man who was about to celebrate his biggest defeat of Musa. And it didn't work out like that. He was a favorite. Supposed to sweep Musa in four games. It didn't happen. Instead, the underdog won. And his anger now, to the point where the Quran captures this, says, look, I'm going to torture you. And the way that, and I don't mean to be, you know, graphic, but the way that Fir'aun would torture individuals sometimes, cut one limb of one side and the other limb of the other side. Right arm, left leg. Left arm, right leg. Tie him to a tree, the trunk of a tree, let them bleed out. That's cruelty. And when they were threatened with that, it didn't shake them. You do whatever you want to us, they would say. To who? To Fir'aun. But you can't make us unsee what we saw. You can't take the belief away from us. No longer are we ignorant. Are we ghafil? Are we heedless? Now we know. And once we know, we can't unknow. These were young individuals. And I see a dimension of that in today's youth as well. Not all is lost. Yes, I know there is concern, and there should be, but there's always concern. When I was growing up in this city, 14, 15, there's lots of concern back then. We should never be not concerned. We'll let our guard go down. But when you look at historically, very quickly in the beginning of tonight's lecture, when you look at historically, you look at three major events in Islamic history. One, of course, was the establishment of Islam by the Prophet of Allah in Mecca and Medina. One, of course, was this commemoration, the days of Ashura. And one will be the arrival of our Imam. And the one common denominator in all three of them are the young. The Prophet of Allah would give very difficult responsibilities to young people. And back then, and it's still kind of holds true today, back then the culture was, if you were older, a little bit of whiteness in your beard, you were wiser. If you were younger, you were a little bit foolish. And you couldn't be trusted. Right? So the known sort of custom was that if you need something done properly, you have to ask the elders.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صابر مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين
Siyutu
Çoman
Yani
Bazaar.
Wherever you go, you are surrounded by real estate, whether they are houses, offices, shops, hotels, or education, or even healthcare facilities. These buildings are all the products of Realty Development. Property is a multi-business. It can involve buying land and building on it, renovating or improving, or converting property from one use to another. All of which adds higher value to the area. Property developers quite literally build the world around us, creating and changing the environments we inhabit and use on our daily basis.
Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will take a look at Iran's housing and light construction industry. We want to uncover how this market is doing and what contributions it is making to living standards along with the economy. Time to light up today's Bazaar.
In order to become more familiar with the activities of light construction in Iran, we decided to visit a real estate developer in the capital city, Tehran. Nexa Group was established over a decade ago and is a known name in the construction industry. Essentially, it develops luxury properties for residential purposes. In a nutshell, a developer adds value to land or property. What sets this company apart from other developers is its choice of cream-of-the-crop architects who are highly creative, innovative, and experienced in the field of design. Clients who have land they wish to develop can seek the services of this contractor. This company then enters a contract with the owner and begins the process of vetting architects for designing its buildings. In recent years, several competitions have been held by this developer for residential projects. The winning design that meets the high standards of this company and its clients is awarded the project. But that's not all. This company also has a vast network of highly specialized subcontractors to take care of other aspects of construction, such as structure engineering, excavators, and so on. Among its many activities, this developer provides building management services. Such services include maintenance of plumbing, electrical, and mechanical installations of the building.
There are several different types of property development. Some are large scale, meaning that several lots of land are being developed into a single plot. These types of developments can be subdivided and sold individually or as a whole. There are also developments for commercial and sports uses, such as shopping centers and stadiums. Ooh, I like the sound of this.
Projects at this company range from low to medium density residential buildings. This developer also pays particular attention to designing buildings that are environmentally friendly. Most of its buildings are constructed following green practices that also elevate the living standards and quality of experience of its end users. One of its most recent residential projects is called Phoenix. What is most unique about this building is that it was designed based on the traditional 9-square method of Iranian architecture. This green building incorporates the needs of people during the coronavirus pandemic, which includes spaces for working from home. Large investments are made in real estate development each day, but adding value to the property, such as luxury structures with numerous amenities, are what really drive profits. And this company is ready to work with foreign investors and export its services along these lines. One of the competitive advantages of this developer, relative to others in the country, are its innovative and exceptional designs that gain the attention of clients and customers. Its luxury developments are geared to entice customers with more accommodations, higher-end options that integrate an entire lifestyle, and an elevated culture of living. The quality of its work has increased competition in the domestic market, making its buildings a must-have among customers. This property developer also has a unique view of the US-imposed sanctions, which has helped the company thrive throughout the years.
Iran has a growing population of around 85 million people, and the majority of the population is still young. But as time goes by, this population will age as they start families. With this in mind, many of them are embarking on the journey of purchasing homes. And for this to become possible, more housing units need to be constructed to meet this growing need.
The Ministry of Roads and Urban Development estimates that the per capita of housing for each Iranian is around 200 square meters. This means that 17 billion square meters of buildable land is needed to house every Iranian. According to the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development, the annual demand for homes stands at 900,000 units. In more general terms, according to the Ministry of Housing, some 10 million units are currently needed. This is while the average annual production volume for homes is around 300,000 units. So around 1 million residential units need to be built each year to satisfy this demand. Figures from the Statistics Center of Iran show construction of housing increased by nearly 40% last year. Data from the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development show municipalities issue an average of 350,000 residential construction permits each year. Of this amount, roughly 70% lead to construction. However, experts say this is not nearly enough to meet annual housing demands. Last year, the housing construction market saw a slump in completing projects. This was mainly due to the jump in land prices and construction materials that deepened the housing recession. The Ministry of Roads and Urban Development says housing prices have increased by 200% over the last 5 years. This has increased the purchase parity, making some vulnerable groups unable to buy a home.
It might be interesting to know that this issue has gathered the attention of the government for some time now. The government has implemented initiatives to help people purchase homes. One of these initiatives was to increase the amount of bank loans for first home buyers. Several other plans are also underway, such as the vacant house tax plan, to increase the amount of available homes.
President Ibrahim Raisi has pledged to build 1 million residential units each year for the next 4 years. This scheme was presented to address and prevent a housing shortage in the country. The Building Contractors Association says planning, execution, and building material is available. It emphasized that with large investments and land allocation, this plan can easily go forward. But authorities contend that infrastructure such as electricity and water connectivity requires more planning. Government officials also say wrinkles in the financial model for this project still need to be ironed out. Iran is entirely self-sufficient when it comes to construction material, according to the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. Steel, glass, and cement is produced in abundance in the country. In fact, the surplus of these items are exported to several countries around the world. Meanwhile, the light construction industry in Iran is booming amid a long housing recession. New spaces and innovative designs that incorporate the needs of people are being built. Homes are not just a place to live, they are increasingly being seen as a source of capital and a place to increase the quality of living standards. There is also a growing trend towards designing sustainable buildings that reduce emissions and negative environmental impacts. All these achievements make this industry a promising one with a bright future. It is said nearly 70% of the world's protein comes from animal sources. While the plant-based trend is popular for the time being, meat is here to stay. Protein is also a brain food, vital for neurological and other bodily functions. Moreover, globally, the relationship between humans and livestock is fascinating. It has transcended time and space. Yet, despite all the world's technological and scientific accomplishments, mankind has failed to replicate livestock's exact contributions to food, clothing, and even energy. Last time, we visited Khazai Agricultural and Livestock Breeding Complex and explored their agricultural and cultivation units. This time, we will look at their advanced animal husbandry divisions and what led them to livestock rearing. To begin with, it all starts from the soil. Over time, the ground needs constant enrichment for high-yield harvests. After this company shifted to knowledge-based potato cultivation, it realized the best way to prepare the farmlands for the next round of planting was to employ the help of sheep. This company has around 2,400 hectares of farmland, and fertilizing this much land becomes a mammoth task. So, it decided to bring in the heavyweights of the fertilizing sector and started its cattle breeding unit. And as a result, it also launched its animal feed production facility, where they scientifically formulate feed and test ingredients for the best quality. As the cows are allowed to roam the lands periodically and are fed high-quality food, the dairy and meat they produce are also very nutritious. They have thousands of Holstein cattle at their rearing unit, and the milk produced is rigorously tested.
Typically, livestock is fitted with digital tags. This is the animal's profile, which can be modified or added according to the animal's examination. They also serve as an identity card so caretakers can keep track of each animal's health and other features. This is also important information for veterinarians and the animal's products, which are further examined in advanced labs.
Each animal born or brought to the facility is given a digital tag after a lab examination. This company's advanced veterinary and genetic lab complex carries out essential functions. It's worth mentioning that one of its labs is mainly dedicated to testing cows and their milk. Here, milk is tested for its microbial load. This usually involves a standard plate count, which determines the total number of bacteria in a sample. These results are then used to determine the grade of milk. It might be interesting to know that this company has received numerous awards for being the best model cattle breeder in the province and the country. These titles were granted based on meeting nearly 40 standards of the Ministry of Agriculture. Such achievements were made possible by dozens of expert staff employed at this company. Its other laboratory is dedicated to raising sheep. At this facility, sheep are genetically selected for specific characteristics. They are also genetically bred to produce twins and sometimes triplets. This company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its facilities further while incorporating new technology and applying the latest science to increase the quality of its products.
...2019 was considered the golden period for red meat production in the country. Since then, production has grown each year, primarily because of the removal of an export ban. 3 years ago, Iran imported large amounts of meat to supply domestic needs, while domestic meat production was operating at full capacity. The ban was implemented to stabilize the market and support local production.
Iran's Livestock Exporters National Assembly estimates domestic needs for red meat at around 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, this number was 72 million, which is well above average. This meant 12 million light livestock were ready for culling and exports. The Ministry of Agriculture puts red meat's domestic per capita consumption at over 12 kilograms, with lamb being the most popular red meat. This year, the National Statistical Center, or SCI, reported red meat production stood at nearly 51,000 tons in the month of May alone. Based on the SCI figures, over 1.3 million livestock holding farms are spread across the country. 54% of these farm small livestock and 26% are dedicated to large livestock husbandry. The remaining 20% farms both large and small livestock. The meat industry in Iran is worth some $2 billion. But not all livestock are raised for meat. They are also reared for their milk. Based on the SCI, Iran annually produces nearly 9 million tons of raw milk. 70% of this amount is produced on industrial farms, and the rest comes from traditional dairy farms. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, on average, roughly 800,000 tons of raw milk are exported annually, valued at around $800 million. All things considered, Iran's livestock industry is booming and is an excellent place for investors who will see quick returns and profit.
Now it's that time of the show for me to step aside for several minutes because my good friend and colleague has another awesome field report lined up for you. Take it away.
The basis of the steel industry is iron ore. It's courtesy of this critical raw material that the steel is all around us. In the beneficiation process, the gank minerals, or the mineral matter of no value that occurs with the metallic ore, is removed from the mineral substance and iron ore concentrate is produced. The concentrate is then shipped from mining plants as a bulk commodity by rail.
Hi again. The wagons carrying the iron ore concentrate have reached their destination. What happens at this stage is that through a gargantuan machine, they are overturned. This is called a wagon tippler. What it does is that it tips the wagons. Look, it retains the wagons from the top and it overturns them. First, the wagons are detached from other wagons and then they're lifted over here. And look at those arms. Look at those arms, how gigantic they are. And now they're gonna retain the wagon, overturn it to empty its load into a container. From that container, the iron ore concentrate is going to be mixed. First, it's going to travel through some distance and it's going to be mixed with some additives to be fed into the pelletizing process.
In this week's feature program, we visited Chotormalu Industrial Facility, located in the center of Iran, Yazd province. The iron ore concentrate must be pelletized for use in iron and steel making. In summary, pelletizing is achieved by combining the iron ore with water and a specific binder, which is then rolled up in a balling drum to produce relatively uniform pellets, which can then be easily handled in downstream processes.
And here we are. The powder is the iron ore concentrate now mixed with some additive. It is now fed into large discs. In this industrial complex, everything is just enormous. This is called the pelleting disc. It's really huge. Now what happens here is through the use of centrifugal force, the powder gets compressed and it's just pushed to the edges of this disc. And after the powder completes a couple rotations, and as it grows in size, then it forms the pellets. And once it is just large enough, it will exit the rotation because of that centrifugal force and it moves over to the conveyor belt and is now time for grading. Now, those particles that are just perfect in size and shape, they will move on to travel over to the kiln where the content moisture is removed and sintering takes place. So the iron pellet now gets hardened. And after that, cooling takes place. Now, stay with us for more.
Chotormalu's pelletizing plant, with a production capacity of 3.4 million tons per year, employs 500 people directly and another 3,000 indirectly. The iron ore pellets will be transferred to stackers and are piled in an area which can store 300,000 tons of pellets.
Fe2O3, I don't know how familiar you are with chemistry and the chemical reactions and the periodic table, but anyway, at this stage of the process, Fe2O3 is going to be turned into Fe through a process that is called direct reduction of iron. And this process is done by three main stages. The first stage occurs above furnace. The pellets are poured into the furnace. And what happens inside the furnace is two gases are going to hit the pellets. The gases are carbon monoxide and molecular hydrogen. They're extracted from natural gas through a process that is called reformation. And two gases are going to hit the pellets, and through three chemical reactions, Fe2O3 is going to turn into Fe, which is called the reduced iron, or also sponge iron because of its high porosity. Now, this process can be done in two different ways. One is called hot direct reduction of iron, and the other one is called cold direct reduction of iron. Now, I'm going to move on to the next and the final stage, steel production.
Hot direct reduced iron, or HDRI, is DRI that is transported hot directly from the reduction furnace into an electric arc furnace, thereby saving energy. Whereas cold DRI is the one that is cooled and stored before being charged to a furnace. Well, on the face of it, there is no reason for facilities to even consider cold DRI, but in reality, it's not really that simple. The development of mankind would have been impossible but for steel. It fueled industrial revolution and remains the backbone of modern industrialized economies. The process continues with primary steelmaking, which is done via electric arc furnace at Chotormalu, and then moves on to secondary steelmaking, which involves treating, continuous casting, and shaping.
The final product is made, the steel billet, and you can tell how hot it is in here. Well, the process here starts with the electric arc furnace. It melts the sponge iron that I talked about earlier. And what happens next is that we need some ladles. Ladles are containers. They're going to contain the molten material. Then the ladles are taking over some molds. Molds are going to carry the molten material. And as the molten material is carried over,